Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
Look, I talked to Shakir on Thursday. He is obviously hopeful that he'll be home with his wife and four children after 14 years. But on the other hand, he's had so many promises that until it happens, he's not going to keep his hopes too far up. He wants to get on a plane and he'll believe it when he lands in London.
A recent interview with the lawyer of Guantanamo detainee Shakir Amer. Well, Amer did touch down in London today. He was the last British detainee held at Guantanamo Bay. Amer was held there for nearly 14 years without charges or trial. Military officials have portrayed Amer as a dangerous Islamic terrorist, but there was never proof or charges brought. Human rights advocates are calling him a victim of the war on terror. At Guantanamo, Amer served as an unofficial spokesman for detainees, drawing attention to life inside the prison and leading a mass hunger strike there. Amer's release comes nearly 7 years after President Obama pledged to close the prison at Guantanamo. Erwin Chemerinsky is a constitutional law scholar and dean of the UC Irvine Law School, and he's here now to talk about the case. Welcome.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to have you, too. Well, so he was cleared back in 2007 for release. So why has it taken authorities so long to get him back to the UK and released?
I think that's such a crucial fact in this case. The Bush administration cleared him in 2007. The Obama administration cleared him in 2009. In fact, of the approximately 114 detainees who are still at Guantanamo, 55 have been cleared for release. And it's just astounding that someone would be cleared for release, deemed no longer to be a terrorist threat, and still held in captivity, in this instance, for 8 years.
And those 55 cleared for release, is that because they can't find a country to take them?
For the majority of them, it's because they're from Yemen, and the United States doesn't believe that if they release them to Yemen, there's enough security to make sure they don't go back to terrorist activity. And so even though there's no proof they've ever been terrorists, they sit and wait because there's not a secure country to send them to.
But in this case, there was. And in fact, the highest levels of British government had appealed to the Obama administration for his release for a long time, and yet he still stayed there.
He was apprehended in December of 2001. He was taken to Bagram, where he alleges, and where there's strong evidence, he was tortured. He was then brought to Guantanamo in early 2002 and has been there ever since. And we've got to remember, when we're talking about from 2002 to now the end of October 2015, that's longer than any war in American history. And I want to highlight what you said. He was never tried, not in a military tribunal or otherwise. In fact, of all the individuals, about 780 who have been held in Guantanamo overall, only 8 of them ever were tried.
And the Bush administration even admitted there was no evidence against him. What was he initially accused of?
Well, bounty hunters were paid in Afghanistan to name those who had ties to al-Qaeda. We now know from reports of the Senate Intelligence Committee that many of the bounty hunters simply named rivals to get them out of the way or gave names to collect the money. Now, it was alleged that he was linked to Osama bin Laden. It was said that he was a recruiter, a facilitator, a financer of terrorist activity, but none of this was ever proven.
And then he became sort of, as I said earlier, kind of a spokesman for the detainees, and he led the hunger strikes, and he was put in solitary confinement. Do his lawyers say that one reason why he wasn't released was that he was so vocal, such an opponent, a vocal opponent to what was happening at Guantanamo?
The honest answer is we don't know. We do know that he spent long time in solitary confinement. We know that he was an unofficial spokesperson. We do know he led the hunger strike that you mentioned back in 2005. Amnesty International said, and I'll quote, "Given the time involved, the lengthy spells in solitary confinement, and the torture allegedly used against him. Shakir Amir's plight is one of the worst of the detainees held at Guantanamo, and that comes from an independent organization.
Right. His lawyers are saying that he's in very bad health, and that was one of the reasons that they gave for appealing for his release. Is he saying that he was tortured not only at Bagram, but also at Guantanamo?
Yes. And in fact, we know from the Senate Intelligence Committee report that came out this past December that many who were held in Guantanamo were tortured. And what was done to them by every standard of international human rights constitutes torture. Now, we don't know exactly what was done to him, but we know of Guantanamo detainees being subjected to waterboard, forced anal feeding, and things like that.
And so of the 114 or so who are left, how many of them are considered dangerous terrorists?
Well, we don't know the answer to that question. And of course, we can't know the answer because none of them has ever been tried. None of them has been formally indicted. We know, as I said, that 55 of the 114 have been cleared for release. Of those who remain, how many are actually dangerous? How many were there because a warlord was given a bounty to give a name? We just don't know.
So is there a process now to try to speed up the release of the remaining 55? I mean, this is something that President Obama had wanted to do from the beginning of his tenure as president, close Guantanamo.
President Obama pledged at the beginning of his presidency to close Guantanamo within a year. It hasn't been closed, obviously. President Obama said on many occasions that Guantanamo is a symbol that embarrasses the United States, that it's used to recruit terrorists against the United States. The problem is that Congress passed a law that prohibits the transfer of those from Guantanamo to prisons within the United States. And so the question is, for those who have not been cleared for release, where do they go if they can't be released to the United States? And it's just astounding. We pay $3.3 million per detainee to keep them locked up. And so there's a real cost in human terms, in monetary ones as well.
Mm. But if they have, see, I want to go back to these, the ones, the 55, that you say many of them would have to be returned to Yemen. If they've been cleared for release, then presumably they're not considered a terrorist threat. So is the administration afraid that they will become radicalized if they're released to Yemen?
Well, the federal statute says that they can only be released when it can be assured that they won't return to terrorist activity. The problem with Yemen is it's impossible to give any kinds of assurance of what happens there. So about 50 of them are from Yemen. They've been cleared for release, and they continue to be held. For others who've been cleared for release, and some who have not yet been cleared for release, the problem is finding a country that will take them. I think the Obama administration, in its waning months, is going to do everything it can to release as many detainees as possible. And I think it's going to look for any legal avenue to try to close Guantanamo to carry out Obama's pledge. On the other hand, the Republican Congress isn't going to budge on this.
But he can release them, right, without approval from Congress, as long as it's not in the United States.
Yeah, right? I mean, he can certainly release them. What the law specifically says is that they cannot be transferred to prisons in the United States. The question is, for those who are regarded as the most dangerous, what do we do with them if they can't be released to prisons in the United States and we don't want to release them to the rest of the world? And the idea of individuals being literally locked up for the rest of their lives without trial is so inconsistent with our Constitution and all notions of international justice.
Erwin, great to talk to you.
Always. Thank you so much.
Erwin Chemerinsky, constitutional law scholar and dean of the UC Irvine Law School. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think? Should Guantanamo be closed? What do we do with the detainees there when there's no country willing to take them? What do you think? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out to us on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, speaking of prisons and the president's legacy, 6,000 drug offenders are being released from federal custody today and on Monday. Nearly a third of them will be turned over to immigration and will likely be deported. And most of the rest are already out of prison. They're in halfway houses or home confinement and will now be released to a probation officer. This particular release stems from a decision by the U.S. Sentencing Commission 2 years ago to cut sentences for drug offenders by 2 years on average. And here to talk about this is Mary Price, General Counsel of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, first off, who are these prisoners being released? What were they convicted of?
Well, all of them were convicted of drug offenses, and were convicted of drug offenses that carried terms of incarceration that were, in some cases, very, very long. The average sentence length, I think, was about 11 years, and it's going to be reduced about 2 years to roughly 9 or 9.5 years. But a number of these prisoners had sentences that were extremely long, much longer. In fact, we've heard from people who were sentenced to die in prison, who were able to benefit from this. So it's an absolutely remarkable moment.
And so 6,000, is that the total number, or will more be released?
No, there will be more. The Sentencing Commission, which, as you pointed out, made these changes and then made them retroactive, it estimated that approximately 46,000 prisoners serving federal drug sentences in the Federal Bureau of Prisons will be eligible for consideration of this change.
All right. So of the 6,000, many of them were already in halfway houses or home confinement. They'll now be under parole, as I said. Does the federal government bear any responsibility for helping them with reentry drug programs or getting them a job or anything like that? Or is it up to the states?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a mixed bag, really, in terms of the federal government. While people are incarcerated, there is some programming that people are eligible to receive, including residential drug abuse treatment. A number of people go through that program if they, in fact, have a substance abuse problem. Prior to being released from Federal Bureau of Prisons custody, the Federal Bureau of Prisons is supposed to guarantee that those prisoners have an adequate amount of time to prepare for reentry into the community, and that means time in community confinement or halfway houses and or home confinement. And the problem that I think the Bureau of Prisons is facing right now is that the large number of people coming out has strained the resources and contracts that they have with halfway houses. So we do know of some people who are leaving right to the street starting today or tomorrow. So that has been an issue. As far as the states are concerned, once the prisoners are released today, they do go now into supervision by U.S. probation officers. But the states certainly do have a responsibility, and many of them are stepping up to provide services to help ease people's transition into the community. I'll say one more thing. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems that we've had with over-incarceration and the number of people in the Federal Bureau of Prisons is that every dollar that's spent to lock up a nonviolent drug offender is one that cannot be used for other purposes, fighting crime and so forth. And one of the things that can't be funded as adequately as it ought to be are funds from the federal government to state and locals to help them with just this kind of reentry support for prisoners.
All right. I want to broaden this out now and bring in Wesley Lowery of The Washington Post. Welcome to the program, Wes.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the president has been on a legacy building campaign lately around ending mass incarceration. So how does this square with his larger agenda?
Well, certainly this fits into the type of agenda laid out from the first campaign run by then Senator Obama, as well as the agenda laid out by Eric Holder and now by Loretta Lynch. I do think there's some frustration in the administration that they haven't been able to more quickly make more movement on these issues. Even the kind of criminal justice reform legislation that's currently proposed in both the Senate and the House doesn't go quite as far as either the president or the attorney general or most advocates and advocacy groups would like to see it go. However, again, we have currently seen a push around some federal action to undo some of the drug war policies and specifically to address this idea of mass incarceration.
Right. And this has been a bipartisan issue.
Certainly. I mean, in many ways, some of the leaders, at least politically on this, early on were state governments, were governors of Republican states, because they came in, many of them were elected as budget hawks, and they sat down and they made these campaign promises, we're going to slash spending by this much, we're going to slash the budgets by this much, and they soon realized, well, wait a second, we spend most of our money in our prisons. How can we deal with this? And so that is actually where a lot of the current criminal justice reform push, at least politically, really began and how it started to grab hold.
Okay, so I understand that Hillary Clinton is releasing her criminal justice platform as we speak.
Yes, I believe she's talking right now.
And so you got to look at some of the details. What do we know so far about her plan?
Of course, and it's worth noting that, you know, while she's coming out with some details today, she still has put out much less in, as it relates to criminal justice reform than Bernie Sanders and as Martin O'Malley. What she has said, what she's saying currently is, you know, she's going to call for the complete abolition of the crack and powder cocaine distinction, which, you know, was a law that was passed in, I want to say 1986, that decided that if you were caught for a crime that related to crack cocaine, you would receive 100 times the sentence of the same amount of powder cocaine. Now, this was thought that, you know, crack cocaine was related to more violent crime, or it was that it was part of this crime wave. But in reality, what it meant was that black people were getting sent to prison for much longer sentences for doing the exact same crimes that white people were doing with the same drug, only in a different form. The Obama administration walked that back to an 18 to 1 ratio with the Fair Sentencing Act in 2010, but what Hillary Clinton's calling for now is a full abolition of any disparity, making it a one-for-one sentencing.
Right, but this is something that would have to be done legislatively.
Yes, and essentially what she's arguing is that she would support legislation to do this. This would be among her legislative agenda as president.
And she also says she wants to ban racial profiling. How can she do that?
Well, again, and this is another case in which she's saying she would support legislation. And she, in fact, as a senator, has supported this legislation previously. Democrats in Congress have, since 2000, 2001, been introducing this End Racial Profiling Act. And what that would do is it would ban any law enforcement from using race-based determinations for why it might pull you over, or why it might frisk you, or why it might move you to the other line as you're going through TSA. This was something that actually had a ton of bipartisan momentum until 2001, when 9/11 happened, and we started to have a much more counterterrorism law enforcement posture. And as we know, a lot of counterterrorism law enforcement does rely on some level of racial profiling.
Mm-hmm. And just profiling in general.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. And so what do police officers and police chiefs think of that?
Police chiefs typically push back on that idea. They're much more likely to agree with the getting rid of something like the crack powder cocaine distinction. And we saw a lot of police chiefs in the last few weeks come out and endorse this idea of criminal justice reform. But when it speaks to profiling, it's something that, you know, many chiefs argue is important and is a vital part of how they figure out who they need to interact with and who might be breaking the law. So that's the type of proposal that gets much more pushback from groups like the National FOP,
right,
or the police chiefs organizations, versus reforms of the prison and sentencing system, which many police chiefs love the idea of blaming the other part of the justice system for this conversation.
Right. So you mentioned that the other candidates have more detailed proposals, at least on the Democratic side. What are their proposals? And can you also talk about it on the Republican side?
Of course. And so, again, both Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley have rolled out, in many ways, just a longer list of proposals, right? You know, Hillary Clinton says she's going to continue rolling out new details over the weekend and next week. What's been interesting is, you know, Martin O'Malley came out first with a full kind of comprehensive criminal justice reform platform that included a lot of policing reform, which is not something that necessarily is included in a lot of politicians' platforms. So calling for special prosecutors, calling for better data to be kept about policing interactions. And so it really was a fascinating platform he laid out. Bernie Sanders laid out a racial justice platform, which was really fascinating. So it related to a lot of different issues related to voting rights and the restoration of the Voting Rights Act, or the parts of it that were struck down in Shelby versus Holder, the Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm.
He talked a lot about getting rid of marijuana as a federally classified illegal drug, making it so that, you know, states can legalize drugs if that's what they choose to do. He's also called for the abolition of all mandatory minimum sentences. And so, again, we've seen very robust policy platforms from many of the candidates. On the right, we've seen less policy. I mean, and part of this speaks to, in some ways, kind of the ebbs and flows of a campaign. What we've seen much more kind of tax policy come out of the Republican candidates and less criminal justice reform policy so far. I believe Rand Paul is the only candidate who has a full platform out currently, although some of them have talked about different aspects of it. And so on the left, you have many more details have been released publicly.
Yeah. It's interesting, though. The Koch brothers, I understand, are big about reducing sentencing and That's one of their issues, and that the Republican candidates haven't taken up that mantle as of yet, except for Rand Paul, as you mentioned.
Exactly. I mean, the Koch brothers, in fact, have a summit next week in New Orleans where they are amassing a ton of political operatives, a ton of local kind of state legislators. It's interesting, though, because I think that all of the Republican candidates have voiced support for the theoretical idea of criminal justice reform. But that's different than laying out kind of detailed policies and what that might mean. Now, many would argue, actually, that a full platform of a presidential candidate may or may not matter in this space, because so many of the reforms that would be potentially needed, or the ways you would reform the criminal justice system, largely have to take place at the state level. And so there is kind of a federalism question here of what can the president even do on some of these issues. And so like I said, it's not completely black and white and cut and dry, but it's been fascinating to watch the campaigns try to deal with these issues.
Wesley Lowery, national reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. And earlier we heard from Mary Price, General Counsel of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, who would pay $115 million for a house? Ultra-luxury spec homes are being built in Bel Air. One of them has a champagne room, as in a room where the walls are filled with champagne. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You're in the market for a house. What are your must-haves? More than one bedroom? A backyard? Or how about a champagne room? Not just for storing booze, but a whole room designed to look like a champagne glass, or a race car simulator, or a 15,000-foot guest house. Those are just a few of the amenities in a new development called the Park Bel Air. The Park Bel Air consists of three mega mansions laden with indulgent perks. It's the latest in a series of super-sized spec homes rising in Bel Air. So what does this mean for the neighborhood and LA's real estate market? Candace Jackson is a real estate reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She wrote about these mega mansions in today's paper. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us more about Park Bel Air. I can't get enough of these details. They're incredible.
Yeah, it's definitely unusual, particularly in price, but also in size. I mean, the houses, there's three homes, and the smallest of the three homes is 55,000 square feet, I believe, and the largest is 61,000 square feet. So each home is larger than the White House, just to give a little perspective. And it's a development of three homes where the prices start at $115 million, and with upgrades and extras and furnishings, they go up to $150
million. I think that's so funny. Upgrades from $115 million. Like, how could you get fancier than that?
And these homes just basically have everything you never knew you wanted. I mean, you mentioned the champagne room. It's a chilled room designed to feel like you're actually in a glass of champagne. You can also store your champagne in this room, but it's a rotunda with bubbles sort of going up glass walls, and it's a very unusual design.
Wow. Who came up with this design, and who is designing these homes, and who's building them?
So the designer is Gavin Broden, who is an L.A.-based designer and architect who was best known for overseeing the renovation of the Spelling Manor, which is one of the largest homes in L.A. It's 57,000 square feet, sold for $85 million several years ago to a young heiress who was, I think, 23 at the time she bought it, and she remodeled it, and he oversaw that. So now he's doing the Park Bel Air, which is being developed by a developer out of London. And they say they saw an opportunity in L.A. for sort of this kind of international trophy home buyer that really wasn't being met. There's a demand out there for these types of homes, they say, and L.A. was a little bit overlooked.
Really? Okay. Well, so trophy home meaning what? That they won't actually live in the home?
Typically, yeah. This level of buyer is someone who owns multiple homes. You know, they'll probably have a home in London and New York and maybe Hong Kong or Singapore and Monaco. So they'll go back and forth between, you know, 2 and 10 different homes. So it's not likely that these homes will be a primary residence for whoever buys them.
And so there is demand for this.
You know, that is yet to be seen. The first of these houses just came on the market, but there's definitely the sort of top end of the real estate market has gotten more international in the last few years, meaning that buyers aren't just looking in a few cities. They're sort of looking to create like an international portfolio of homes. That market has been strong, even though it's a very tiny market, of course. So there is potentially demand. Of course, it's small demand because very few people can afford to buy these homes. But yeah, there are buyers looking for these, you know, sort of trophy mansions.
So there's another development under construction in Bel Air that is even more outlandish, even more expensive, $500 million for this house.
Yeah, it almost makes the Park Bel Air look like a good deal, right?
It does. Who's building that and who's going to buy it?
Yeah, that's being built by a local developer, Niall Niami, who has built numerous really high-end spec homes and mansions. And he says he's going to put it on the market when it's completed sometime next year for $500 million, which is just an absurdly high price tag for a private home. We've never seen a home sell for that much money anywhere. The priciest home that is what is thought to be the priciest home that sold in the world was in London a couple of years ago for $221 million. So this would shatter that record if it got even close to $500 million. And he says the same thing. You know, this house is being built for a billionaire who's sort of adding to a portfolio of trophy homes around the world. He said to me, I think whoever is buying this house is going to have 10 other houses. Nobody buys a 100,000-square-foot house as their principal residence to use every day.
No, they get a small condo.
You can't actually live in a house that large.
So what do the neighbors think?
The neighbors aren't thrilled. I mean, obviously, Bel Air is an area that's been known for really high-end, you know, often very large homes, you know, for many years. But these homes are sort of another level size-wise, price-wise. And, you know, the process of building them is really disruptive. Neighbors say that, you know, the sort of narrow, winding streets of the neighborhood get clogged up by trucks that are excavating the land for months or years at a time. And, you know, another fear that one of the neighborhood groups brought up to me was that, you know, they're worried these places will take years and years to sell or may never sell, and they'll become kind of like white elephants just sitting in the neighborhood. And, you know, they don't really love the idea of these homes being vacant most of the time. Even if they do sell, they'll probably go to, you know, a buyer, like I said, who isn't there much.
And does having homes in this big and this expensive, does that have an impact on the rest of the real estate market in Los Angeles, or is it its own little bubble, this luxury, ultra luxury real estate market?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a lot of ways, it's its own very small little bubble. It doesn't necessarily impact kind of the regular home market in LA, but in some ways, I think it can impact the regular market in that, you know, you hear about a home listing for $100 million or more, and it sort of gives the impression that the luxury real estate market is going gangbusters or doing really well. I mean, whether or not a home sells for that price, you know, it just sort of boosts optimism and interest. And, you know, that can help people kind of think positively about the high end of the real estate market and maybe strive to sell their home for a little bit more or, you know, build more homes like this. And, you know, that can affect the overall real estate market in some ways.
And are these developers just allowed to build whatever they want? Are there any requirements on how big and how lavish they can get?
It sort of depends where you are. In Bel Air specifically, there hadn't been a lot of restrictions, from what I understand, on what developers could build. And that's one of the things homeowners in the area have been trying to change in the last year or two. So they are adding some more restrictions on, you know, the size of the home you can build relative to the lot, how much land you can excavate, on these building projects, that sort of thing. So it is going to become a little bit more restrictive for developers in the coming years.
And I guess they're not required to build affordable housing to go along with it.
No, I don't think so. Although the tax money that these houses bring in, I mean, if you think about what the taxes would be if you paid $500 million for a house, you know, it could be I think it's between $6 and $8 million a year. So developers like to point that out, that these houses will be bringing tax money into the city.
Candace Jackson is a real estate reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Candace.
Thank you.
All right. Do you live in Bel Air? What do you think about these ultra mega mansions going up around the block? Or do you just have thoughts on these new giant mansions? We'd love to hear them. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's our weekly movie roundup, and among all the horror, there's a bit of candy too.
I never would have put those two together, but it's a real peanut butter chocolate situation.
Find out who our critics find delicious after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Plenty of thrills and chills at the movies this week. A terrifying look into the mind of a political operative, what it's like to be trapped in a kitchen with a megalomaniac, and of course, zombies. Amy Nicholson is chief film critic for LA Weekly. Hi, welcome back.
Hi, Madeline. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Gray Drake, senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
Howdy.
Howdy. First up today, our brand is Crisis, starring Sandra Bullock as a political advisor tapped to help revive the presidential campaign in Bolivia.
Every day, we are going to ring the big feet. El Diario, La Razón, La Prensa. And we are going to spoon feed them their Rivera story. We're going to go through every quote he's ever given, every person he's ever met, every vote he's ever made. And we are going to look for ways of using it against him. And if anyone has any qualms about this, thinks it's wrong in some way, you come and talk to me, okay? I will rent you a nice set of balls. Because there's only one wrong in this. Only one, and that is losing.
Okay, and so then right after that, we learn that no one understood what she said because no one speaks English. Is this supposed to be a comedy, Gray?
It is a comedy,
oh.
And it is funny throughout.
Uh-huh.
I don't care what anybody says. This is a funny movie. I mean, did you hear Sandra Bullock's Spanish accent? It was perfecta. I think I said that wrong.
I think it's perfecto, but
see,
whatever.
It's a funny movie, but it's also a terrifying movie. I mean, this is a movie about Sandra Bullock going in to try to manhandle this election happening in Bolivia that's actually based on a true story that James Carville was a part of in the 2002 Bolivian elections.
So she is supposed to be James Carville.
I think Billy Bob Thornton, he's also playing a competing election operative. Mm-hmm. He's just channeling James Carville. His head is shaved. He's got this southern accent. He's got that skull face going on.
So this really happened, and there was a documentary made about this where James Carville is brought in to prop up this candidate's run, and he's actually not a good candidate, not good for Bolivia.
No, as so many political candidates are, it's always a double-edged sword, right? And so you're going with the lesser of all evils in most cases. And this movie deals with that in a very interesting way. I thought from beginning to end was always fascinating. I was in this movie the entire time.
You really liked it.
Me too. I enjoyed it to pieces, but I was so scared watching it because like we're in an election cycle now. And if we think our elections are terrifying, imagine watching Sandra Bullock try to warp an election, but not even care what the policies are and know that she doesn't have to live there when it's over.
No,
but Americans muddling in Latin American politics, that's pretty serious. And there have been dire consequences. Does it touch on that?
It glances past it. Like watching it, you just get that chill. Like, oh, we're not really having the CIA come in and topple elections anymore. We're just having people do it for money who don't even have an ideological goal behind it.
And a lot of our critics at Rotten Tomatoes, however, disagree with Amy and me. They say that because the movie's not funny enough or not dramatic enough, that it doesn't do anything, which I disagree with. I'm shocked at its low tomato meter rating.
Really?
Yeah.
I absolutely completely disagree with the crowd on this. It's strange. I think we have a problem watching movies that tell us politics are cynical because we get this cynical attitude ourselves. We're like, well, we know that. Come on. But it's important to keep stopping and recognizing that. Just knowing that politics are cynical isn't making us do anything about it. And yet we're refusing to watch films that tell us what we know.
And Sandra Bullock is good in it?
She's great in it. And really great energy between she and Billy Bob Thornton, too. I never would have put those two together, but it's a real peanut butter chocolate situation.
Is there a romance?
There... Thank God. No, not explicitly. Thank you for leaving that out of the story and hinting at it in a clever way.
Right. Instead of a romance, Billy Bob Thornton just specializes in coming up to her and whispering the most foul things in her ear and then just gliding off.
So it sounds almost Frank Capra-esque.
As done by David Gordon Green.
Okay. Next up, Bradley Cooper is a brilliant but self-destructive and arrogant chef in Burnt.
People eat because they're hungry. I want to make food that makes people stop eating.
We're being stupid.
Cooking is an expression of who we are, and right now we're two stars, both of us. It's a two-star review. Now, we can keep on cooking and be interesting, but I want people to sit at that table and be sick with longing. And I need you to do it with me.
Okay, we didn't hear it there, but the trailer goes on to show Bradley Cooper just throwing plates everywhere against the wall. I mean, he is the mad maniac, brilliant chef. We've seen this character before, right, Amy?
We have. Bradley Cooper's spin on it is he's a chef who's been disgraced because he had a heroin addiction, was basically hustled out of France, where as penance, he went to a restaurant in New Orleans and shucked, I think the movie literally says it's 1,000,000 oysters. I was trying to do the math on that. I can't imagine anybody could chuck 1,000,000 oysters in a lifetime. That seems very zen. Mm-hmm. But when he's done with that, he goes to London, decides he's going to take over a restaurant operated by Daniel Brühl, this great German actor. And he's going to like shepherd it to getting at least 3 Michelin stars. It's a strange movie about food because it doesn't actually seem to care that much about food in particular.
But it cares about him and his redemption.
Exactly. It cares about the way that a kitchen is run. It's all about yelling and shouting and who's in control and how can you trust your team and letting go when you have to. But there's not much about, ooh, this flavor. You know, if people are into these foodie movies, I thought Chef did it a little bit better because you really get a sense of in that movie, Jon Favreau combining flavors and enjoying what he's making. This is about more plating and regimentation.
What about Ratatouille? I like that one. That was a good chef movie.
Absolutely. And boy, that rat was the best. Tour de force performance. Who gets hustled out of France for being a heroin addict? Nobody.
Yeah, I mean, like, we've got Jim Morrison buried there.
Come on! I don't believe it for a second.
I will say, I saw Burnt at a screening that was filled with chefs. And when it ended, there was a Q&A with Bradley Cooper there, with Sienna Miller, who's great in this, playing kind of more of like a sous chef type.
And his love interest.
And a chef raises his hand and he goes, I have one real problem with this film. You have a guy using a fork in a nonstick pan.
Ooh.
Ooh. Those are the kind of the details that will doom one of these kinds of movies. They have to be right on and precise, right? In capturing what it's like to be in a kitchen.
Yeah, I really enjoy watching actors play chefs because it's almost like watching an actor play a dancer. You're looking at the footwork, and here you're always just watching the way they handle a knife and the way they handle a pan. And Bradley Cooper's good with a knife. He and Sienna Miller seem to throw their knives around like they know what they're doing. It's just the movie doesn't seem to care that much about the actual food, and that's kind of a bummer. If he wants these meals to make us stop and dream in the audience, we're just seeing a bunch of artistic-looking things go out the door, but we don't really get a sense of it.
And how's Bradley Cooper as an actor in this?
He's good. He's efficient. He's doing that kind of thick-necked, fast-talking Bradley Cooper thing. Uh-huh. He's definitely a real jerk in this film, surprise, chefs are jerks. They're almost like our new, how we used to have all these films about tormented artists who were painters and terrible to their women. Now it's chefs. I guess our priorities have changed as a nation.
But you know what? If you want to watch an angry chef scream and lose his mind, just watch Gordon Ramsay any
Absolutely.
Day of the week.
Absolutely. Right? And that is probably what people should do this weekend. It'll save you some money. Yikes.
Okay, last up, the only actual horror movie on the docket. It's called Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Guys, the police are gone. The military, they're not coming either.
But tonight, we're going to show them what being a real scout's all about. We're just going to stand here, and we're going to go save the world. That was a really good speech, Ben.
Okay, so couldn't quite tell what this movie is about.
Yeah, but do we need to know what it's about, Madeline. It is about a bunch of kids who are ready to leave the Scouts because they want to hang out with chicks. And wouldn't you know, right when they're about to leave, zombie apocalypse in their town. Isn't that always the way?
It always happens that way.
Just right. When you think you're out, they pull you back in.
And so there's a lot of great faces in this movie. You got David Koechner as a scoutmaster. You got Ty Sheridan from Mud, from so many good movies. He's such a young person with so many great credits. And then he's in this movie. And I'm sure that he wanted to have fun. And I'm sure that they had fun. I just didn't get a sense of fun when I was sitting in the theater going, really, guys? Zombie boobs? Uh-oh.
So this is for teenage boys.
Very much so, and I would say even young teenage boys, because of the sense of humor. This is definitely rude, crude, zombie gore all over the place. And normally that exactly describes what I want to see in the theater, but there's something about this movie that doesn't land. And it's not creative as far as zombie kills go and the zombies themselves. And at the end of the day, I was thinking, why would they make a movie for boys this young that's R-rated? Because they can't easily get a ticket.
And why is it R-rated?
God only knows. I have a feeling it's because they were just like, more gore, guys. It's going to be awesome if we just see tons of blood. Maybe someone in the production team owns a fake blood company. Maybe there's collusion going on. It just doesn't, it misses the mark. There are funny moments, there are ha-has, but they're never enough to make you forget what you're actually watching. And by the way, zombie Cloris Leachman should have been the greatest thing I saw in theaters this year. And instead,
she's in this?
She's in this. What they did to her. It, something happens to that character, and that character does something that made me go, you guys take back what you just did to Cloris Leachman.
Yeah, let's remember her in The Last Picture Show.
I know, yes. I had to shower and bleach afterwards.
All right, well, speaking of horror, it is Halloween tomorrow, so tell us your favorite Halloween movies that we can rent, because we're not really going to go see this one.
No, I stand up for Halloween Season of the Witch every single time, because if this hadn't been called a Halloween movie, it would be good on its own. Just the fact that there's no Michael Myers. Give it another shot, everybody. Stop judging me.
Okay. Amy?
I want people to rewatch The Blair Witch Project because I think it is still one of the scariest movies ever made. And it gets a lot of grief because it launched a found footage genre that people have a lot of problems with. But you go back to that original one and it is one of the scariest films I've still ever seen.
I'm going to still plug my favorite, Rosemary's Baby.
Ooh. Fantastic.
The devil's in that. Come on.
Sold.
Sold. Gray Drake, senior editor at Rotten Tomatoes. Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for LA Weekly. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween. Warren Olney, favorite scary movie?
Oh my gosh, scary movie. I guess I don't go to scary movies.
You deal with scary politics.
It makes me nervous. I don't want to do that. No, I'm scared. Dealing with scarier things today, actually, talking about the presence of armed, sworn, uniformed police officers on schools around the country, apropos, of course, of the awful video that we all had to watch for day after day this past week. It turns out this is not uncommon, the presence of the police and their weaponry. And it's really something important, it seems to me, having to do with the educational experience, not to mention, of course, security. Does it really provide security? How do people feel about it? Children and their parents and teachers. Mm-hmm. It's a very important issue. And is there a particular focus, as there so often has been in the case of law enforcement, on African-Americans and Latinos? Turns out there is.
Yeah. All right. Important conversation coming up at 1 o'clock with Warren Olney and To the Point. Thank you. Coming up on this show, continuing with the Halloween theme, sexy ladybug, sexy cat, sexy Donald Trump. How did Halloween become so tawdry? That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tomorrow is Halloween. Americans will spend about $7 billion celebrating this year. About $1 billion of that will go to kids' costumes. And about $1.5 billion will be on costumes for grown-ups. Costumes that, as Lindsay Lohan notes in Mean Girls, are usually a wee bit risque.
In the regular world, Halloween is when children dress up in costumes and beg for candy. In girl world, Halloween is the one night a year when a girl can dress like a total slut and no other girls can say anything about it. The hardcore girls just wear lingerie and some form of animal ears.
Doesn't she look great, honey?
What are you?
I'm a mouse. Duh.
This year, in the sexy mouse category, we have sexy pizza rat, sexy Cecil the Lion Killer dentist, and even sexy Donald Trump. When did Halloween become an excuse to strip down, and what would Vincent Price think of that? Yeah, he'd be laughing. Well, joining me now is Leslie Bannatyne. She's written books about Halloween. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, when did this become a thing, sexy Halloween costumes?
Sexy Halloween costumes. Well, I would say after the year 2000, it became widespread, but there were precedents before. You could see it coming. There were Hollywood studios used to take sexy witch photos of their stars to publicize them in the 40s. And everyone knows Elvira from the 80s associated with Halloween and Coors Beer. And she kind of brought a little bit of sexy to Halloween, too. But you find it just completely rampant starting only about 15 years ago and growing each year, growing on both in the breadth of sexy costumes you have and in how young you can get them.
Well, I guess it goes with Halloween being transgressive and all, right?
Absolutely. It has been transgressive since the beginning, and it's also been associated with, creatures out of the box, creatures on the edge. You know, adults started to celebrate Halloween again in the 1970s when in little enclaves like Greenwich Village, New York, or the Castro District in San Francisco, where there were these amazing gay Halloween parades where everyone was outrageous and the costumes were amazing. And other adults noticed and said, this is actually fun. And it just grew mainstream from there.
So it really wasn't an adult holiday until the 1970s?
It was originally an adult holiday or young adult holiday, say in the Victorian times. Young men and women would get together at Halloween parties. It was a romantic. It was a time to kind of show off your beauty in a different way, in a darker dress maybe. But it was given over to children right between the two world wars and definitely right after when the baby boom happened and there were so many children, and our whole cultural focus kind of turned to kids.
And so now is there kind of a tug of war in terms of adults versus kids, sexy versus non-sexy?
No, I think everybody, the cool thing about Halloween is that everybody celebrates it however they need to. So for kids, it's candy and costumes. And for adults, it's kind
candy
of getting
and costumes.
Out. Yeah, candy and costumes and getting out of your skin for a night.
Right. So how did this all begin, this Halloween dress up tradition?
Halloween's always been associated. It came from Ireland, Scotland, Wales, that part of the world, and it was always associated with the other world, with the supernatural, with the dead. And so, when people started to throw Halloween parties here in America, they kind of kept those themes. And so, in keeping with darkness and supernatural, you got the iconography of witches and black cats and ghosts and things, creatures that were on the edge. And so the costuming came in that way and then just grew with our popular culture. Once we had a popular culture, it became everyone's culture. So the first costumes are like radio and comic book characters. And then you see the influence of television coming in the 50s when people are dressing up like their favorite TV characters. And it just continues in that way. We started to dress up like horror movies in the 80s when there were so many horror franchises. And now with sex everywhere in fashion, film, TV, everywhere, advertising, you find sex in costumes.
And what do you think of that? Do you think that's okay or do you think it's a little too tawdry?
For me, a costume is a personal decision. I think it's fine as long as you know what you're doing. At this point, what I see in sexy costumes, I mean, you mentioned sexy Cecil the Lion Killer, or sexy SWAT team, sexy carrot, sexy sea turtle. I think it's gone beyond sexy to irony and making a comment on sexy,
yeah,
which is the great thing about Halloween. It's a time where you really can be ironic, and that's what I see rather than sexuality.
Are you going to dress up this year?
I will.
What are you going as?
Maleficent, and not sexy Maleficent.
She could be really sexy, though, in
she
a scary,
be, but I
scary
must say
way.
That I'm covered.
Leslie Bannatyne, author who has written 5 books about Halloween. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
sexy sea turtles? What?
That was my favorite one, too. So stupid.
Hi, Jilly Myers.
Hello. And you know that I asked our listeners on Facebook to weigh in with the dumbest sexy costumes that they've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
My favorite that I've ever seen was I was once at Ralph's on Halloween and I saw this man dressed as a giant tortilla chip. And I was like, what is happening? And then his lady friend came up and she was in like red leather everything, like super, super sexy red leather. And then she had a little chili pepper on her chest. She was sexy salsa, Madeline.
Oh, that's cute. Nope. Use the tortilla to her salsa.
Yeah, yeah, cute or ridiculous, that poor guy. Some of the other ones that have been nominated, sexy Nemo from Finding Nemo, not okay. Sexy Chinese takeout, and in this case, the Chinese takeout has a little fortune cookie hat. Not okay. And you know, like the sexy Halloween thing, I get it.
Yeah,
good for you, everybody.
Why not?
Like, sure, why not? Not for me. One thing that I will never say anything bad about is dog Halloween. When you dress your dog up like as a hot dog or as Ben Franklin or as a dentist, I don't care what it is. I will never say anything bad about that because it is the best time
of
year.
As long as it's not sexy. Okay. Thank you, Jilly Myers. On that note, we will hand it over to Warren Olney. And to the point, I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great Halloween, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.